From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And today is the one-year anniversary of another terrible shooting. 9 people killed last year during a Bible study at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. In that case, the shooting was fueled by racism, and that city is mourning today. While we follow the latest from Orlando, Mayor Buddy Dyer spoke today about how the city is helping the shooting victims and their families, including opening up an assistance center.
Over the past 2 days since we've opened the center, 94 families and 256 individuals have visited us for assistance.
Meanwhile, investigators are looking for more details about the shooter, and NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston joins us now with the latest. Dina, what more are authorities learning so far about Omar Mateen?
Well, intelligence and officials and investigators are starting to become much more convinced that the motive for this attack had very little or maybe even nothing to do with ISIS. They've been struck by how closely Omar Mateen, the shooter's biography, adheres to that of a typical mass murderer as opposed to someone who was radicalized. Let me just give you some examples. He was bullied as a kid in school. He had behavioral problems. He was teased because he was Afghan. He was aggressive toward other kids. And then as he got older, things didn't get much better. He took steroids. He was obsessed with control and exhibiting power. His history of domestic violence fits into a mass shooter's profile, too. You know, when it comes to his first wife, he controlled every aspect of her life. He took her paychecks. He kept her in the house. He wouldn't let her talk to her family. He used to beat her. So violence and control and power are often precursors to these kinds of mass attacks. And so investigators are starting to think that maybe ISIS was just a cover for something that Omar Mateen was trying to hide as the real reason for the attack.
Well, and there have been a lot of questions about whether what he was trying to hide was him struggling with his own sexuality. Are we getting any closer to a motive in this case?
Well, it's important to realize that we're still very much at the beginning stages of this investigation. They haven't even finished processing the crime scene at the Pulse nightclub. But what we know now, and there's a lot of information to come, is that investigators believe that Mateen may have been lashing out at the gay community because of his own sexuality issues, as you say. And they see that as a better explanation for what happened than ISIS or radicalization. Now, I've been doing a lot of radicalization stories over the years, and it's really striking how little Mateen falls into that category. No one is talking about his increased religiosity. His relationship with his family hasn't changed. He's still going to the same mosque that he'd always gone to. No one noticed a difference in his rhetoric. And these are all things that countering violent extremism experts tell parents and friends to look for if they want to see the early signs of radicalization. And the sources we've talked to say they haven't uncovered anything like that at all when it comes to Omar Mateen.
Dina, we just have a few seconds left, but any sense that there are going to be others who are charged here?
It's very unclear that there's a grand jury that has convened to look and see whether how much his wife knew, Mateen's
right.
wife knew beforehand, but unclear whether there'll be charges forthcoming.
NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston with the latest on the investigation in Orlando. Thank you, Dina.
You're very welcome.
We've been learning more about the 49 victims of the Orlando shooting. Kimberly Morris, a native of Torrington, Connecticut, was one of them. She had recently moved to Florida and was working as a bouncer at the club on the night of the attack. Ray Hardman from Here Now contributor WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut, has this remembrance.
Kim was just always a happy-go-lucky, carefree spirit.
That's Carice Villarroel, a lifelong friend of Kimberly Morris.
She was friends with any and everyone, and that smile. She just always had this infectious smile that drew you to her.
Villarroel was part of a tight-knit group of friends at Torrington High School in the mid-90s, and Morris was their leader.
She just brought calm to our crazy.
Miriam Akinbobola was another member of that circle. She says Morris, who was gay and African-American, never really had a coming-out moment. She says Morris was always open about who she was, and what really defined her was her love of mixed martial arts, dancing, hip-hop music, and especially sports.
She really just was such a great team player, and she really just pulled people together and inspired them to do their best and was always encouraging people.
Morris played college basketball at Post University in Waterbury, Connecticut, where teammates remember her as a tenacious small forward. Her athleticism and lanky 5'10" frame served her well in her 20s when she became a drag king. performing as a man under the name Daddy Kay.
Incredible entertainer. I think that's how at least I'm going to remember her.
That's Morris's friend Tuti Huerta, who remembers Daddy Kay's performances at the Polo Club in Hartford, Connecticut.
A star on stage. That's what she was, a star on stage. She would impersonate Michael Jackson, Justin Timberlake. When the lights were turned on, the spotlight was on, she was on.
Kimberly Morris had recently moved to Orlando from Hawaii to help take care of her mother and grandmother who had fallen on hard times. She had only been working at Pulse for about a week before the tragedy. Tuti Huerta is convinced that during the rampage at Pulse, Morris leapt into action to help others.
I envisioned her as a person who, instead of running out the door, would probably be trying to save lives, trying to save people, tell people what to do, putting herself at risk before anything else. I wished that I could, you know, go back in time and tell her not to work that night.
Kimberly Morris was 37 years old. She was buried yesterday in Florida. There'll be a memorial service for her tonight in her hometown of Torrington, Connecticut. For Here and Now, I'm Ray Hardman.
Well, people are expressing their grief and their support for the victims in Orlando and surviving loved ones with donations. So let's check in with attorney Ken Feinberg. As we have too many times, he's consulting with the mayor of Orlando and organizers of other funds on just how to dispense that money. And Ken, please don't take offense, but I hate talking to you.
Likewise, you always hope that the last one will be the last one, but it isn't the case.
Yeah. I mean, you have administrated funds for the 9/11 victims after the shooting massacre at Virginia Tech, the BP oil spill, the Boston Marathon bombings, and now Orlando. It's early days, but what are some of the things you are thinking you're going to have to consider?
The immediate issue is, one, is there only one fund, or are there multiple competing funds? One fund is always the best way to go because then you can coordinate with a common criteria. And secondly, how much money do you have or do you anticipate? You can't determine the calculation of compensation until you know the aggregate amount.
Well, so we know that, for instance, the Orlando Sentinel is reporting that the largest GoFundMe page, which is set up by Equality Florida, which is an organization, a nonprofit, we've spoken to them here on the air, they've raised almost $5 million. Then there are 300 other campaigns. But does the city itself have a campaign?
My understanding yesterday in talking with city officials is absolutely yes, a very focused campaign. Now, how much money ultimately will be in that fund, whether they will merge with other funds, all of these issues have to be addressed very quickly.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing more important in any of these funds than getting money out quickly.
So we understand Orlando's mayor, Buddy Dyer, has announced the One Orlando Fund. That's the one you're referring to. I think Disney donated $1 million to that. So you've got all of this different money, and so your concern is to maybe see if you could bring them all together in one fund. And you mentioned that the money needs to be dispersed immediately. We're hearing of people who can't afford funerals, can't afford to fly their children home. So there is an immediate need. Some of the smaller GoFundMes, individual GoFundMes might take care of that. But what are your other concerns that you're starting to think about as the wheels turn and as you think of what you're facing here?
Well, who gets the money? I mean, most of the victims are young teenagers, some with families, some undocumented workers, some with same-sex partners. There's going to be an issue here, I think, more than in most cases, as to who's eligible to receive generous compensation.
You mentioned that some of those killed and some currently horribly injured are undocumented.
That's right. Now, remember, in 9/11, we immediately got a ruling from the Immigration Service that the undocumented in 9/11, the families, knew that receiving the 9/11 money would not result in any penalty or deportation. Those are the types of issues that will have to be resolved if you're going to secure the willingness of all of the victims and their families to participate in the program.
You've also said that in this instance, I'm not sure if you were worried that this might be true or if you already know that it is, but you know, this was a gay club, and in some cases, these might have been young people who were estranged from families.
That's right. Now, the minute there's money to be had, we've found over the years this can promote some tension. Don't let my sister have any of the money. My brother hated my sister. Don't let my mother have the money. You have to set up a process that will prioritize who's entitled to the funds and what they have to demonstrate in the way of proof to justify receiving a payment.
Attorney Ken Feinberg heading to Orlando to help that city disperse the funds that are coming in to the people who desperately need them. Ken, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And by the way, Ken told us the thing that gets him through what will probably be months of interviewing devastated victims and family members is the fact that there is so much money and such generosity.
All week we've been talking about science in America. We've heard from the head of the National Science Foundation, the only physicist in Congress, and we've talked about science education. Today we want to put our series in context with a look back at the history of science. And joining us is David Kaiser, who's a professor of the history of science and a physicist at MIT. He's also the author of a number of books, including How the Hippies Saved Physics. Dr. Kaiser, welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
So who were some of the key players in the history of science, particularly in the 20th century?
Oh, there's such a long list. You know, one thing that's pretty amazing is that there have been more scientists alive and working now than cumulative since the Earth began. So more and more people entering the field over time. So it's hard to pick out, you know, your favorite top 10.
I assume Einstein would be on the list.
I would think Einstein has a pretty good shot. Yeah, we haven't knocked him off the list yet. Other people whose names are well known, like Stephen Hawking, probably are still worth thinking about, to be sure. But it's a huge list, and it has some people who became household names and many, many others who were doing incredibly important work who we might not know so much about.
And when you look at where they're coming from, are they mostly people who were living in the United States or other countries?
There's a huge switch around the middle of the 20th century, sort of basically as World War II was drawing to a close. And the big scientific powerhouses, at least as we measured them by sort of spending on research or publications in the journals, that had really been places like Germany, and it's sometimes in history at Russia and other places. And then in the middle of the 20th century, it really shifted pretty solidly to the United States. An enormous investment in basic research coming out of the war, a huge ramping up of the enrollments in science classes. Think about kind of Sputnik era calls to get more young people interested in science. So by the 1950s, 1960s, the U.S. really had a kind of global dominance in the field.
If you look back over the past 1,000 years, what would be the biggest points in the history of science, the moments that really stand out to you?
Part of what interests many of my colleagues and I in the field is actually looking at things that even in hindsight might not seem to have changed the world. But trying to get into the head of someone who inhabited such a different way of thinking, had different tools at her or his disposal, what even seemed like a question to them. So instead of just finding our kind of greatest hits, which would clearly be biased by our own sort of sense of what's where we are today, a lot of historians really enjoy trying to get into what feels like a different planet, you know, to get into a foreign world. So that makes it harder to create a kind of greatest
hits. But if you had to do it, if you had to come up with a few moments that with this discovery, we are able to move forward to the next step in a number of different fields.
I think about Copernicus and think about how the Earth is moving around the sun. This Earth need not be the static center of the universe. That was a pretty big shift. The shift was not overnight in people's thinking. It took many hundreds of years.
And that was when, Copernicus?
So Copernicus was working in the 1500s. Uh-huh. He published his famous book in the middle of the 1500s, actually on his deathbed. Mm-hmm. And then we have all the great work in astronomy that came to after that, people like Galileo and Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler. And then people like Isaac Newton pulled a lot of that together and really unified an enormous body of work in the late 1600s, early 1700s.
In Cambridge, Isaac Newton.
He was doing a lot of that work in Cambridge. Some of it he had to do out of Cambridge because of the plague. So actually he was in in other parts of England for parts of that. But that's right. He's otherwise based largely at Cambridge. And then, you know, we have a kind of steady drumbeat from there. We would certainly pause to think about the work that Einstein was doing and the world he kind of lived in. And then after that, and again, the numbers then grow so rapidly once we get to, say, the middle of the 20th century. We're talking about an activity that involves, you know, many hundreds of thousands of people. It's an enormous enterprise.
And looking at right now, the period that we're in right now, are we in a renaissance for science at the moment, or does it just seem that way because we're living it?
Well, I don't know if we're in a renaissance. We're certainly, I think, in a moment of transition. I think there was a kind of model, especially in the United States, for how to support scientific research that really, again, grew out of World War II, was really amplified by concerns about national defense in the Cold War. And for a wide range of motivations, what that meant was an enormous amount of money, huge government investment in basic science and in the training of young scientists. And I think there is a lot of frustration these days that model, at least, is no longer at play. So we have some very generous support from private foundations, from generous individual donors, certainly a lot of government support. But the balance has shifted, and I think that, that you can see that in the types of projects that can move forward these days.
One of your books is called How the Hippies Saved Physics. So how did the hippies save physics?
So the title was tongue-in-cheek. But I was writing about this group of really curious, really fascinating people who did their PhDs in the U.S. and some of the leading programs in the U.S. In the late 60s, early 70s, kind of boom years. And then very rapidly, those boom years turned to bust. There's a cycle we've seen repeat a couple times in the last half century. And these folks were caught where their one miscalculation was entering grad school right before the job market collapsed. No funding, no jobs, huge shift in kind of expectations. So they bumbled along. They made their way to San Francisco because if you're going to be unemployed in 1975, you might as well be unemployed in San Francisco. They weren't dopes. They found each other. And they discover they have this shared real passion about these kind of grand mysteries of the universe. What does quantum mechanics tell us about matter at its most fundamental? These are really deep, deep, hard questions. And they really pushed hard on topics that are now at the forefront, like quantum entanglement, what Einstein famously called spooky actions at a distance. These folks were among the early adopters, saying that's really weird and that's really important.
So when you say that, I have to say, and especially when your book is called How the Hippies Saved Physics, I have to wonder whether the drug use in the 60s, seriously, help people come up with ideas that they hadn't come up with before?
It's a tricky question. Certainly, people have made the argument both ways. With this particular group, you know, some of them, at least as they told me years later, had definitely been, you know, kind of stereotypical hippies. Mm-hmm. They spent a lot of time at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, where one mainstay, at least for some folks, was experimenting with psychedelics. We have to remember that many psychedelics weren't even illegal until the mid to late 1960s. These were seen as fascinating substances to expand the powers of mind. They became illicit, and then the kind of culture around them began to shift in the middle of that period. So some of them told me, at least, they were way into the drug scene. Others said, no, that wasn't for me. So it's hard to come down too strong either way.
And I guess we'll never know on that one. What about the dark times in the history of science? What have those been?
Well, again, I think in hindsight, we can see many of them. Ironically, what historians used to call the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, actually, we now think was pretty vibrant intellectually. There's all kinds of cool stuff going on, sometimes in Western Europe, sometimes in other parts of the world, like in the Middle East, in Persia. But there are sort of ebbs and flows in more modern times. And a lot of it, unfortunately, does get tied to the kind of priority cycles in various nations or whole parts of the world. Is scientific research something that society should really invest in and support? Or is it a kind of secondary luxury that's not going to get top priority? And I think you can really see kind of horizons shift. People's imagination can get swept up in whether they can even imagine building a tool to test something or not.
There are also times in the history of science where the government in power at the time, the idea that was coming out from the scientists was so provocative that it was threatening to them. And we look back on that now and say, well, that's terrible. I can't believe that they stopped that person from doing that research. Are there ideas now that do the same thing that we may, you know, 100 years from now look back and say, I can't believe we didn't allow this scientist to continue with their research because that idea was so threatening to the government at the time?
I don't know of too many where the research itself has stopped because it seems a threat. We certainly have, you know, a huge challenge on our hands with understanding things like global climate change, global warming, where there's actually a lot of research going on, and the research lines up remarkably well, but the conclusions to be drawn from that are you know,
difficult for some people to deal with, especially economically, right?
Absolutely. So that's an example where people aren't necessarily censoring the work, although there have been, I think, some real dangerous incursions into the peer review process, into snooping around individual scientists' emails. I think some of it starts to feel a bit like a witch hunt, a kind of McCarthy era thing. Hopefully that's a momentary, lapse. So I don't know about overt censorship. I think my bigger concern would be which amazing, great, crazy-sounding ideas simply couldn't be pursued because of lack of resources, because it seemed a little too beyond the mainstream and couldn't get enough support to really do it. I mean, a lot of scientific research these days is pretty expensive.
On the flip side, if you look back over the history of science, is there a moment when everything worked perfectly, that that there was a place? You know, I think of all of these small college towns around the United States as these wonderful little places where people from all over the world have come and these ideas are melding together. But is there a time and place from the past that we should look to and say, this is the kind of place that we want to recreate now?
I don't know. That's tricky. I think nostalgia can be a kind of false guide here. So there are some constants, some things that never change in university life. Faculty always claim the students aren't working hard enough. Students always complain about, you know, this and that. Faculty need more parking spaces. I mean, there's some things that simply don't change. And people saying they don't have enough resources to pursue their research is one of those kind of constants. So here's an example that sometimes people would say, well, what about this golden age of Galileo? He was given, at least for a time, enormous resources by private patrons, by the de' Medici family, to pursue his work. Wasn't that a kind of, you know, glorious isolated space? Until he realized, well, it didn't quite work out that way. He had all kinds of trouble maintaining ties with the leaders. The new pope wasn't so pleased with some things he was writing. So it's hard to find a kind of golden age when everything just clicked. But I don't know that we have I don't know that we ever sort of got it right and should go back to that. It's a constantly kind of moving stream.
That's David Kaiser, who's a professor of the history of science and a professor of physics at MIT. Dr. Kaiser, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
The Senate approved a defense bill this week that includes a provision that will require women turning 18 to register for the draft. Now, the U.S. hasn't actually used the draft since 1973 during the Vietnam War, but young men must still register when they turn 18. And now that women are allowed to serve in combat positions, there's a push for them to register as well. Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. And Phil, did this approval come as a surprise?
I don't think it surprised a lot of people, because as soon as the Pentagon dropped the restriction on women serving in frontline combat roles, it naturally followed that Congress would try to catch up in law. And this is one way that advocates for that equality are doing so. We should make clear that this is only in the Senate version of the bill right now. It still must be reconciled with the House, and then the president must sign it for it to become law. Right now, the president has a veto threat on this bill, so if it gets to him in the current version, he will veto it, although not over this provision about women in the draft.
Well, there are opponents, including Republican Senator Ted Cruz, who says he could, in good conscience, vote to draft our daughters into the military, sending them off to war and forcing them into combat. But we know that while women under this law might be drafted into the military, should the draft ever be reenacted, isn't it also still true that by law they have to qualify to get into combat positions?
They do. The Pentagon is implementing all kinds of new standards and practices to be able to field women into these posts. But in terms of the practical policy here, it's very remote. This is more about politics. It's more about symbolism and about where members of Congress feel they need to be in this election year on this issue for those that are in cycle and those out of cycle. Cruz believes that it's good politics for his Republican voters in Texas, especially, for him to oppose what he calls this social engineering program. But there are other members in the Senate who view this as a natural step to catch up with what the Pentagon has already done.
Yeah. And so what is the conversation, if there is any, about reinstating the draft?
Well, Congress would need to change the law to bring the draft back. So it would have to act with this bill this year, which is still an open question, and then it would have to act again in some future crisis in order to reawaken this system that it used only most recently in Vietnam. It's theoretically possible the U.S. could face the kind of huge national crisis that would require a return to selective service, but it was so unpopular that it would be opposed by a lot of people in the country, and the Pentagon itself does not support doing that. It likes having an all-volunteer force, which it says enables it to have a much more selective approach in terms of who it can bring in for the military services.
So as you said, this bill, you know, has a ways to go, but if it is finally passed, if it isn't vetoed, what would happen if a woman turning 18 did not register with Selective Service?
That's a great question. The Defense Department, the Selective Service Agency, and the new administration of whichever president is elected would have to work together and figure out how to actually implement whatever the final language is. Very likely it would look a lot the way it does for young men when they turn 18. They get a card in the mail that says, confirm this information or fill out this information, and your local draft board in a crisis would use it to reach out and do a lottery to call you up in case that were authorized by Congress.
And if you don't, you could lose federal aid, Pell Grant. So there are punishments or consequences if you don't. We'll continue to follow this story, see what happens with this bill. Phil Ewing, NPR's national security editor, thanks as always.
Thank you.
All week, as part of our series, A Nation Engaged, NPR is looking into the question, does your vote matter? Today, we want to hear from a man who was at the center of a moment when every vote did matter.
And right now is moving our earlier declaration of Florida back to the too close to call column.
Sound familiar? That audio from November of 2000 when George W. Bush beat Al Gore by less than 600 votes in the key swing state of Florida, while Ralph Nader, the Green Party candidate, got nearly 100,000 votes in Florida.
Nader's doing two things in this election. One, he's taking the Green Party towards that magic 5% number, which would qualify them for matching federal funds. And in certain states, he's hurting Al Gore.
And many still blame him for George W. Bush's election in 2000. So here we are in 2016, which is shaping up to feature two presidential nominees with historically bad favorable ratings. Could this be the year for a third party? Ralph Nader joins us from the American Museum of Tort Law, a museum he started in Connecticut. Ralph Nader, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, I want to start with the election that's going on right now. And you were quoted last month as saying that Hillary Clinton was going to win the Democratic nomination by dictatorship. Do you think that the primary on the Democratic side was a fair fight?
Well, I meant a party dictatorship. The rules of the Democratic Party favor the establishment candidate. They have closed primaries in many states. And that favors the establishment because it's very hard for independent voters to get in. And they favor Bernie Sanders substantially. And there are all kinds of little ways that the Democratic National Committee can favor the establishment candidate. It can reduce the number of debates. It can schedule the debates at times when there are major sporting events. And that's what I meant. It wasn't really a Democratic procedure inside the Democratic Party.
But the fact that Hillary Clinton has won millions of more votes in this primary process, does that make you think that at least she would have gotten it any way you sliced it?
Well, that's another problem, a winner-take-all system. I like proportional.
But I'm saying even when you look at the overall popular vote, she's well ahead.
Yes, but, you know, the system doesn't reflect this the popular vote. It reflects who wins the most elected delegates. But in this case, there are 20% of the superdelegates that aren't elected, mostly cronies of Hillary Clinton and the Clinton political section of the party.
So would it be fair to say that you're a Sanders guy if you had to pick between these two?
I don't pick between two. I don't like the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I think they are indentured to big money, super PACs, with the exception of Bernie, of course. Now, I believe in voting your conscience, which means there are small parties that offer options too. The Green Party that's probably going to have Dr. Stein as the candidate, or the Libertarian Party that has already nominated the former governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson. There are other parties, too, and you can always write in your vote. I believe in maximum choice for the voters.
And do you think that this is the year that we're going to have one of those third-party candidates on the debate stage? Do you think they can get to that 15% in the national polling in order to qualify?
They're not going to get to the 15%. That's an incredibly high hurdle that historically has almost been off limits to third-party candidates. And so the debate commission is going to have to be pressured by public opinion, by media reviews, by asking who's on the board of this debate commission, so they lower their private barrier down to, say, 5%, which is a more reasonable barrier.
So I imagine that there are a lot of people listening to this who are saying, you know, I agree with everything he says right now, except I don't want to go for the perfect and allow Donald Trump to become the president because I vote for who I really want instead of voting for Hillary Clinton. How do you respond to those people?
Well, I think voters in a democracy should vote for anybody they want, including write-in or even themselves. I don't believe in any kind of reprimand of voters who stray from the two-party tyranny and from the commonality that these two parties have demonstrated in terms of allowing big money to corrupt politics, allowing Wall Street to override and take much control of Washington, and allow our foreign policy to be so militarized. If you don't deny major candidates your vote, you can't possibly change it. That's the only language they understand, Jeremy, is to deny them the vote. Having said that, I think Hillary Clinton will defeat Donald Trump because she has the greatest ally, which is Donald Trump defeating Donald Trump. He is unself-controllable. Not just uncontrollable, he is unself-controllable.
There are a lot of people who still blame you for George W. Bush's victory in 2000 because you ran as a third-party candidate, and it was so close in Florida that it, you know, if it hadn't been for the votes that went to you, people would say those votes may have gone to Al Gore in bigger numbers, and therefore he would have been the president. But what do you think about that now, 16 years on?
Well, I believe that's inadvertently a political bigoted comment, because if we all have an equal right to run for election, as we do, and we're all trying to get votes from one another, as we do, then we're either all spoilers of one another or nobody is a spoiler. Because if they call third-party candidates spoilers, but they don't call their major opponent in the other party a spoiler, they are assigning a second-class citizenship to the third-party candidacy. Having said that, what about 250,000 Democratic voters voting for Bush in Florida in 2000? What about all the shenanigans that distorted honest vote counting in Florida? What about Mr. Gore not getting his home state of Tennessee? What about the political decision 5-4 of the Supreme Court, which should never have made that decision, to block the Florida Supreme Court's ongoing recount in Florida? In short, any one of those, everything else staying the same, Jeremy, would have won for Al Gore. And Al Gore knows this, which is why he does not blame the Green Party.
So what do you think about people who do blame the Green Party?
I think they're fact-deprived. They're either fact-deprived because they don't go through the facts as I've just narrated them, or they're looking for scapegoats. The Democratic Party felt chagrined that they couldn't defeat a bumbling governor from Texas with a very poor record on children and on pollution and other things. And so they're looking for a scapegoat as to why they didn't landslide him, and the Green Party was a convenient scapegoat. That's not the first time major parties have scapegoated third parties and tried to turn them into third-class citizens.
How optimistic are you, Ralph Nader, that the system is going to change in your lifetime, that third parties will be able to compete very well in elections?
Well, actually, I'm quite optimistic because, first of all, we're going to get more billionaires and hopefully some more enlightened ones going into the presidential and senatorial elections in the future. That's one benefit of the Ross Perot and Donald Trump candidacies. Second, the barriers to third parties are beginning to be reduced. There have been many lawsuits brought by the Green Party or the Libertarian Party or the Conservative Party that have cut back in state after state, so that the barriers are becoming more surmountable to give the voters more choices and voices. And third, you look at the polls, they show about 60% of the American people want a viable third party. Well, maybe if we have instant runoff voting, maybe they'll start voting for a third political party and not simply say, well, we're going to go for the least worst because we know only one, a Republican or Democrat candidate, can win.
Who are you going to be voting for this time around?
My vote is always private. I think I like the privacy of the vote, so I don't say, but it's not hard to conclude who I'm not going to vote for.
Well, I can tell that you're not going to vote for Trump, but would you say you're also not going to vote for Hillary Clinton?
I never vote for a corporatist or a militarist. I never vote for Wall Street over Washington or wars of aggression by candidates who even scare our generals.
That is Ralph Nader, who is the author of Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And, of course, he was the Green Party candidate in 2000. Ralph Nader, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
This news we're following today, track and field's governing body says Russia's team will be banned for the Olympics in Rio this summer. The International Association of Athletic Federations upheld a suspension that was imposed in November after the World Anti-Doping Agency alleged state-sponsored doping, cover-ups, and corruption in Russia. Russia's Ministry of Sport said it was extremely disappointed and said the country has done everything possible to fix problems with its system to prevent and catch athletes who cheat. The International Olympic Committee could still decide to allow the Russian team to compete, but it could also decide to ban all Russian athletes from the Olympics. The IOC meets next week, and we'll be watching.
A father who lost his daughter in the November Paris terror attacks is suing Twitter, Facebook, and Google. Reynaldo Gonzalez, whose daughter is Noemi Gonzalez, says the websites provided material support to the Islamic State by letting them use the social networks to spread propaganda. Twitter said in a statement that the lawsuit is without merit. So we have there a story about social media, but other stories filter through social media. Let's take a look with Femi Okeh. She hosts the stream on Al Jazeera English and joins us from Washington. And Femi, the lawyer for the father, is arguing that these social media companies violated the Federal Anti-Terrorism Act by giving them a voice on the Internet. There's another lawsuit pending against Twitter by the widow of an American killed in an ISIS attack in Jordan last year. So what's been the discussion about all of this?
Well, Robin, it's been well known by social media sites that they do have criminal activity on these sites. For instance, Twitter regularly closes down accounts when they feel that they are connected to ISIS or any terrorist or armed group. The same too goes for YouTube. But they rely on users to actually report the activity. So there is a button to report unusual usage or to block accounts, and then they follow up on that. But if you think about how you set up a Twitter account, you don't even have to use your real name. I could call myself at Robin Young. Mm. Fabulous, and set up an account right now, literally before the end of this segment, and start tweeting out and put all kinds of material on. And it could be weeks before Twitter realizes that I might be tweeting out criminal activity or perhaps recruiting. So that is a major problem for them. They do police it very tightly. YouTube does as well. YouTube will, as soon as they know about an account and they feel that it is an account that may be dangerous, they will close it down. But they can keep popping up. So how do they even police this?
Yeah. Well, we're going to follow and see what happens with these lawsuits. Obviously, the families think that they should. But let's take a look at some other stories gathering steam on social media. One about Emily Austin, the sideline reporter with Fox Sports Florida. But she was actually, I think, on some sort of internet thing. What happened?
Well, she was on Facebook Live. If you haven't come across Facebook Live, it's a bit like cable broadcasting, but for the Facebook generation. So you can stream live and you can do little reports and they can go out on the over the internet, and a little bit more informal than perhaps doing a show on Fox Sports, for instance.
Well, so, not as informal as she made it.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. She was chit-chatting on a show called Barstool Sports. It was very laid back, very relaxed. And one of her comments was, "I didn't even know Mexicans were that smart," followed by comments about Chinese people and Jewish people. And the more she tried to say, "I didn't mean it like that. No, I didn't mean it like that." She just dug deeper and deeper and deeper. You know that saying, you know, when you reach bottom, stop digging.
Yeah.
She dug beyond bottom.
Yeah.
Now, this is the internet. Who is paying attention? Her bosses were paying attention. She is now fired. I'm actually right now on Twitter. I'm looking at her account at Emily Austin _. And her last tweet says, "I made a terrible mistake. I was in an environment where I was trying to be funny and made a joke, and my comments were insensitive." She says that. She still doesn't have a job.
Well, a cautionary tale there. But one last story. Donald Trump touted his appeal with the LGBT community this week, talking about how the gays love what I've said about banning Muslims and immigrants. What's going on with the reaction on social media?
So Donald Trump said at a rally, "I am a better friend to the LGBTQ community than Hillary Clinton. Just ask the gays." Of course, in a nanosecond, you had hashtag ask the gays. The gay community replied with some amazing memes and comments. Things like, "Go home, wig." and lots of comments that actually just show that maybe Donald Trump doesn't have the best of friends in the LGBTQ community. It was fast, it was swift, it was a fierce response. I highly recommend you look online and look at hashtag AskTheGays. It will entertain you for at least 15 minutes.
It was also very kind of important conversation because he assumed that the gay community would agree with his banning on immigrants and Muslims. He says they know what they think and what they do, Muslims and immigrants, not only in Saudi Arabia, not really remembering that many American gay lesbian citizens are Muslims, you know. So, swift reaction there.
Yeah.
Femi Okay, she hosts the stream on Al Jazeera English, and it helps us look at how the news filters through social media. Femi, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
And, you know, as we head into this weekend, lots of people planning on heading to dance clubs to show solidarity with Orlando, with the gay community. I highly recommend Jeremy's piece from yesterday with an Orlando DJ. You can get that at hereandnow.org. But someone sent me Ellie Goulding's Army. She wrote it about her friend Hannah, and it seemed fitting. Give a little listen. When I'm with you. Wish you a wonderful weekend with your army after this incredible week. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.